That's where the activation occurs, but that's not where the oxidation occurs. The oxidation occurs in the matrix of the mitochondria. So you now have these activated fatty acids that have to be brought into the matrix of the mitochondria. And this is Friday, November 19, Biochem 421. All right, so as you notice in the previous diagram, you've got this PPI that gets hydrolyzed by a pyrophosphatase. And that's another way that enzyme reactions are driven to completion. This invariably, this pyrophosphate comes from ATP going to AMP. And they have this thing just sitting there and driving it, hydrolyzing it, provides additional free energy, as I said, to drive the reaction to completion. Enters the mitochondria now for beta oxidation. So how do you get it into the mitochondria? Well, again, through the outer membrane, it's not a problem. The inner membrane is the problem. And the long-chain acyl-CoAs can't pass through that. However, acyl-carnitine can, because it gets transferred in there through a carrier. And that carrier is called carnitine palmitoyl transferase. This is assuming, of course, it's a palmitic acid. Typically, that's the most common fatty acid. There are others that also transfer through this carrier protein. So the acyl-carnitines then are translocated across the mitochondrial membrane by the carrier proteins. Then the acyl-CoA is reformed and the carnitine is transferred back. The short chain can simply diffuse. Let's take a look at this diagram right here. Here's the activated fatty acid with the CoA group. Here's carnitine, free carnitine. There's that enzyme, carnitine palmitoyl transferase, that moves that fatty acid group onto the carnitine. The carnitine then carries it into the matrix through the inner mitochondrial membrane. The reverse occurs. Free carnitine is regenerated, sent outside, and so this is a very simple loop situation that occurs primarily. There's no free energy loss. So this occurs primarily by simply mass action. The high levels of fatty acid are out here. They simply drive it by concentration gradient into the matrix. Yes?
The CoA is the reason why the fatty acid can't go through the membrane? Because it's on both sides.
Yes, apparently so. You would think that the simpler way of doing this would simply be to have acyl-CoA, not a carnitine carrier, but a CoA carrier, wouldn't you? I can't explain it. It's one of those mysteries I'm going to have, literally, one of the mysteries I'm going to have to ask God why he did it in this way and not simply had a simple carnitine carrier. It may be due to regulation issues. I don't know. But that is the sole purpose of carnitine in this aspect of it. Yes? Well, you mean this CoA right here? Why is it there already?
Well, because isn't your anti-chain transferred over with it already? You only keep the RCO over with it.
Correct. Yeah. In other words, that there's this cofactor or whatever that's on this side and on this side. Whether or not they are generated. You know, I don't even know about the synthesis of this CoA here.
It can't get transferred as a whole.
It's not being transferred as a whole. So the CoA, that's an excellent question. I do not know. I've never been asked that question. How is the CoA existing on this side, on the cytosolic side, and on the matrix side right here? Is it somehow synthesized one side and carried across? Or is it synthesized on both sides by different mechanisms? Because the mitochondria has some DNA of its own. Whether that makes the that CoA, I don't know. Good question. But nevertheless, the carnitine is simply designed to carry the fatty acid equivalent from one side to the other side, and just that's it. And then it reforms that CoA, the acyl-CoA. Here's this compound. You can see it right here, carnitine. And there's, of course, the acyl group and the transferase. So they're just showing you the structure of the carnitine. It's a relatively simple thing. It's got that amino group. and a carboxylic acid group in that. So it's what? How many carbons? 1, 2, 3, 4 carbon unit, and it's got that amine group on the end. Not surprisingly, that wouldn't be able to be transferred without having some help because of the positive charge and the negative charge simply couldn't pass through. But of course, there is no positive and negative charge on the CoA that I know of. Why it just doesn't simply diffuse, I don't know. Excellent question. Food supplement makers have claimed that carnitine is a fat burner. Fat burner. In other words, that you can take a carnitine supplement. Is it in fact a fat burner? In this context, does it have anything to do directly with the fat being burned or oxidized? No, it's simply a transport protein or a transport compound. And so it you know, you have to wonder about why they call it a fat burner. It would only work if your carnitine is, if you have a naturally low level of carnitine and your body's deficient of carnitine. But carnitine is something that your body makes readily. It's not by any means a vitamin requirement or anything. So unless you're genetically deficient in carnitine, taking carnitine as a fat burner would only give you very expensive urine because it's highly water soluble. All right, let's go ahead, shall we? All right, now there's not much to fill in here. You've memorized this process before, is that correct? We're going to review it. And this turns out to be my favorite enzyme is in this pathway. There are lots of enzymes that I marvel at. This one is especially, this is the one that really I find extraordinary. This one right here, acyl-CoA dehydrogenase, or you've abbreviated it sometimes as AD. Here's the fatty acid, CoA. You got your CoA there. You got the carbonyl group from the fatty acid. Of course, that's the alpha and that's the beta carbons. That alpha hydrogens are particularly acidic, susceptible, as you know, due to the influence of the carbonyl group right here. So that makes sense that it can extract that relatively easy. But here you have an enzyme called acyl-CoA dehydrogenase that in a single step takes a saturated carbon bond and makes it into an unsaturated carbon bond. At room temperature, at atmospheric pressure, at 37 degrees in water-based solution. If you recall all the convoluted messing around you had to do to make a double bond in organic chemistry, and how many reactions did you know of that were a single step from an alkane to an alkene? Well, as far as I know, and I taught organic for 10 years, I don't remember a single one except at extremely high temperatures and pressures for simple hydrocarbons like ethane or propane. But nothing, certainly, at this. Again, a marvel of biochemical efficiency that in a single step you go from single bond to a double bond. Once that double bond is there, then it becomes a very quick understanding of all the processes. I mean, this is organic chemistry writ large here. You add water to that, and of course that gives you an... What functional group is that? Alcohol. Then you oxidize the alcohol, and you get... carbonyl group, and that carbon, because it's on either side of a carbonyl group, is particularly susceptible. It's highly acidic, and therefore this coash can come in here, break that off. You get the acetyl-CoA, and you reform that acyl-CoA, only two carbons shorter, and guess what? You do it all over again. And those electrons here go through electron transport chain, end up in the electron transport chain here, where they eventually make ATP. That's where this ends up. Lots of energy in oxidizing fats. Lots of energy in oxidizing fats. Let's see exactly how much energy there is, actually. Any length acyl-CoA can be a reactant for that pathway. Let's see here. Let me just go ahead and fill this in. All right. So there's four words to fill in. The first one is dehydrogenation. Wow. Again, organic chemistry. Hydration is the second, making that alcohol. The third word there is oxidation, which gives you the keto group. And then you have this Claisen-ester cleavage reaction. Ever hear of a Claisen-ester? Oh, yeah. Yep, very common organic reaction for that. This is why organic chemistry is a prerequisite for this particular class. Biochemistry is basically applied organic chemistry. All right, so do you have all that written in? There's really not much to make a statement beyond that. This particular slide is kind of like show and tell. It's not going to have that much impact on any kind of quizzes or tests, except for the fact that if I go through and I ask you to classify the different kinds of reactions in beta oxidation, you can simply easily classify them. You make a double bond, you put a water on it, you oxidize it, you cleave it. And then you do it all over again. Now, how much energy do you get out of it? Well, this is the ATP production for one fat molecule composed of three palmitic acid molecules and glycerol. Three palmitic acid molecules. Now, what I've done here is I've assumed, if you don't mind, if you want to write this in here, if you notice, I've assumed that the NADH produces 3 ATP. In other words, this is presuming that the P-to-O ratio is 3. Your text typically defines it as 2.5. Your text defines it typically as 2.5. They claim that the oxidation of an NADH gives you 2.5 ATP. This calculation here is with an older form in which I presume that one NADPH is 3 ATP and an FADH2 is 2. All right, so with palmitic acid, there are 7 rounds of oxidation. Each round gives you one FADH2, one NADH, and one acetyl-CoA. Each acetyl-CoA goes to the citric acid cycle. It gives you 3 NADH, one FADH2, and one GTP. The final round of acetyl-CoA, I mean, with the last time you broke it, you get 2 acetyl groups out of it. You get NADH, FADH2, GD3P. And so you end up making 129 ATP per fatty acid molecule. And that means you get a total of 387 ATP for the fatty acids in one fat molecule. A tremendous number compared to how many ATP do you get out of a glucose molecule that gets oxidized. Well, depending on how you count it, it's either 32 or 34, sometimes 36, something along that line, if it goes through a citric acid cycle. So a tremendous amount of energy in a fatty acid, in a fat molecule. And I've not even described what happens to the glycerol. The glycerol also gets oxidized. And I would like for you to do a little assignment for me, if you would, writing on this page. Determine, okay, so here's an assignment that I want you to link to this particular page. Determine the fate of glycerol. Determine the fate of glycerol as it's metabolized to carbon dioxide. I want to use it up. Determine the fate. Let me give you a little hint. It has to do with fructose metabolism. Fructose metabolism. All right. Especially in the liver. All right, let's go ahead, shall we? Because that was mostly show and tell. All right, so let me fill this out. Yes?
On the test, were you expecting 3 or 2.5?
Yes, I will. Or I will tell you what to take, which one to use. I'll take either 3 or 2.5. You should be able to have the mental, the intellectual flexibility to accept either one of those two as possibility. All right, now, all of us are vegetarians here, is that correct? None of us eat meat, and I'm glad to hear that. Because if you recall, remember the professor had the Twinkie diet? You know, and he had 1,500 calories a day, and he still lost weight, and his blood chemistry was just mighty fine. You remember what happened when he began to eat meat? What happened to his blood chemistry? He was still eating 1,500 calories a day, but he added meat, and what happens to the cholesterol level? It went up. You're telling me that Twinkies are healthier than meat? Yes, I am. A good, you know, if you would like to have, you know, baked potato, salad, peas, and then three Swiss rolls. That would be healthier for you for Sabbath lunch than to have all that and have a little 6 ounce or 8 ounce steak. Sorry. That's just the actual fact. All right, so is it harmful to eat a little meat every once in a while? No. People who eat a lot of meat, guess what they get? Heart disease and colon cancer. Because your intestines are not designed to hold rotting meat. Okay? All right. Now then, final round of oxidation yields propionyl-CoA. That's odd chain. 15, a 13, a 17. If you're eating vegetarian, which most of you should be, you're going to get some odd chain fatty acids from the plant material, and your body can handle it just fine, thank you very much. But notice that the last beta oxidation, you're not going to end up with a 2-carbon unit, you're going to end up with a 3-carbon unit. Now, I told you, and I meant it, that 2-carbon units from fatty acid oxidation cannot be made into glucose. I said, how many carbon units? 2. I didn't say anything about 3. So at the tail end of beta oxidation, where you get this one molecule of propionyl-CoA, the body does some unusual things with it to be able to manage it. Let's take a look at it. All right, so here's the propionyl-CoA that comes from the last oxidation of an odd-chain fatty acid. What the body does is add another carbon to it. So using propionyl-CoA carboxylase, which not surprisingly uses what kind of prosthetic group? Biotin. Makes a 4-carbon unit. Notice the stereochemistry of it. All right? Now, the stereochemistry of an S-methylmalonyl-CoA, there's an enzyme called methylmalonyl-CoA racemase that changes it into an R group, and then methylmalonyl-CoA mutase changes that 4-carbon unit that's branched into a linear 4-carbon unit. So the mutase changes into succinyl-CoA. Notice here, this is the methylmalonyl-CoA, which is branch-chained, and here is the succinyl-CoA, which is linear. So, what is the final, not the final fate, but an intermediate fate of an odd-chain fatty acid fragment? It goes from 3 carbons to 4 carbons in a branch chain, and from 4 carbons in a branch chain to 4 carbons straight chain, and that becomes succinyl-CoA. Now, the fascinating thing is this mutase. Reaction 3 is catalyzed by methylmalonyl-CoA mutase. Uses 5' deoxyadenosylcobalamin as a prosthetic group. This is a derivative of cobalamin or vitamin what? B12. This catalyzes a carbon skeleton rearrangement. It's the second of only 2 vitamin B12 requiring reactions known. The other involves folate metabolism, which we'll get to in chapter 22, I think. 21? Anyway, amino acid metabolism. That's homocysteine to methionine reaction. So this enzyme right here is where vitamin B12 is used. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Notice this complex thing. I look at this, and they've got a huge diagram in your text. They've got a huge diagram of this, half a page thing. It's just massive. This is actually, it looks odd, but this is actually cyclic. Notice the bond length. This is cyclic down here. But that's cobalt right there, and that's a carbon bond right there. That's the temporary carbon that's either there or not there in during this reaction. It's exchanged during this reaction, shifting it from a branch to a straight chain. And so it's the only known carbon-cobalt bond known in nature is vitamin B12. Cobalt, ladies and gentlemen, cobalt. Notice again the other structure around it. It kind of looks like porphyrin ring. Where do you find other porphyrin rings? In red blood cell. If that's the case, you have what metal right in there? But if this was magnesium, what material would you have there? Chlorophyll. Imagine the importance of the importance of chlorophyll. You know the importance of the heme group. You know the importance of vitamin B12. That, again, but all these other structures couldn't have happened by accident. Somebody had to design it. Okay, let's go ahead, shall we? Now, we all know that we're not supposed to eat saturated fats. Is that correct? What are we supposed to eat? Supposed to be unsaturated fats. Unsaturated fats. But what happens if the saturation position of your fat doesn't help or doesn't match what it is in beta oxidation? Man, I need to go back real quick. Let me remind you exactly what I'm talking about. I hope you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen. Doink, 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 and we'll play this one. Notice, if you would, where is the double bond here relative to the carbonyl group? Huh? Yeah, it's alpha right there, isn't it? Between the alpha and the beta. And that's vital to have it there. It can't be, you know, it can't be shifted over one, and it shouldn't be conjugated. So, because that changes the mechanism of it. Well, no, conjugated with another double bond. I apologize. It is conjugated with the double bond of the carbonyl group. Yes, exactly. You're absolutely correct. All right. Well, let me play this again, and I'll run through this. This won't take too long to get it back. Now, there's only two things here to underline. The first one, of course, is position, the word position here. And the second is conjugated. Let's take a look at this, shall we? You've now just had some of the healthiest Krispy Kreme donuts you've ever had because it was deep fat fried in unsaturated fat. Yes! Oh, well. At any rate, and so you're going along right here. Linoleic acid, for example. You're going along, that cleaves, and suddenly there's a double bond right there that doesn't allow this to be used. Notice it's not an alpha-beta, it's a beta-gamma. It's out of position. It doesn't fit in the rest of the beta-oxidation pathway, does it? Say no. You believe me? Yes. Don't believe me, ask the dishes. Oh, well. All right, now. So what happens is, so you got a problem with that. So what the body has done is come up with an enol CoA isomerase, and guess what that thing does? It simply moves it from a beta gamma to a what? Alpha beta. Then can it go on? Yes, it can. But notice now what happens. You go on, and you end up now creating a situation where You create this normal alpha-beta double bond, but it is now conjugated, and that changes its chemical characteristics enough with another double bond that it has trouble. A conjugated double bond is created by the formation of trans-delta-2 enol-CoA during the first step of oxidation near an already present double bond. There's a mammalian system and E. coli system. For those of you who wonder why bacteria still manage to survive despite our onslaught of years of antibiotics, it's because bacteria are smarter than we are. And here's proof. In mammalian system, there's a two-enzyme step that has to occur. One is they take an NADPH and reduce that double bond, which shifts reduce the double bond and shifts it over to this position, which is intermediate between the two. And there's an isomerase that shifts it back into the correct position in continuation of beta oxidation. That's a two-step process requiring two different enzymes. However, in E. coli, that's done in one enzyme. They do it more efficiently than we do. I mean, I claim that shows that they're smarter than we are, but wouldn't you think so? I mean, if they can do it in one step and it takes us two steps? So notice again what's happening here. You've got this double bond that's conjugated in mammalian systems. You reduce one of the two double bonds, which creates one right there. You isomerize it, and then you can go on. Okay, that's how you handle unsaturated fatty acids. And this continues to go on. The whole point of all this manipulation is for that those unsaturated to continue into the what? Beta oxidation. They don't want to have a completely different form of it. Yeah. Right. Purposely does that. Yeah. I mean, why does it do that? What kind of double bond do you have in the beta oxidation pathway? What kind of double bond do you got? What kind of double bond is this? That's trans. Well, why is trans fatty acids bad for you? Probably not because of this. There are probably other reasons. Dealing with transport and so on is maybe that reason. All right. Now then, boom, 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 boom. Oh, too far. Back up. I didn't stop soon enough. Do I have my stop sign there? I should have my stop sign. There it is. Okay. There's my stop sign. Let's take a look at it now, ladies and gentlemen. The top line is indirectly. Indirectly. The next blank is not. Next blank after that is pyruvate. After that is malic enzyme. Malic enzyme, we'll see that in photosynthesis. After that, we have greater than 22 carbons long. Peroxisome is the next blank. Oxygen is that next to the bottom. And the last blank is catalase. Catalase. All right. So, what do you get when you have an odd chain fatty acid? What is the final fatty acid fragment that you get from oxidation of a fatty acid? It's a three-carbon unit called propidyl-CoA. What's the body do to it? Adds a carbon to it to eventually make what? Four-carbon branched, then four-carbon linear. The name of that is called what? Now, succinyl-CoA. Now, where in the world do you find succinyl-CoA? Yeah, right there. Okay, so you got the succinyl-CoA here. And so it enters in from the odd chain fatty acid. But remember I said all these intermediates were in catalytic amounts. Is that correct? So if I add an extra succinyl-CoA here, I've then added an extra minute amount of extra intermediates in here that then can subsequently be drawn off. And that's exactly what happens. It gets drawn off, made into malate. So from malate, the malate leaves the TCA cycle. So three of these four carbons came from where? Three of these four carbons for malate came from where? Beta oxidation came from that propidyl-CoA fragment. Agreed? Hello? Everybody out there? Okay. So, then what happens with malate? Well, oddly enough, we add a carbon, then we remove a carbon. So this malate gets acted upon by this malic enzyme. It actually synthesizes NADPH. Isn't that handy-dandy right there? And you end up releasing carbon dioxide to make that pyruvate. Where do you think the pyruvate then goes? The pyruvate then goes to the top of the citric acid cycle and enters like pyruvate that comes from glucose or whatever. So the ultimate fate of that three-carbon propidyl-CoA ends up getting made into pyruvate and then can enter into glycolysis. Into the Krebs cycle. Is that right? But also pyruvate is the first carbon, first three carbon unit for what? Synthesizing. pathway, gluconeogenesis. So that propionyl-CoA can then be made into pyruvate, which then can be made, going back up glycolysis, can be made into glucose. That's the only way you can make glucose from fat. And that happens only every once in a great while.
Is that like our version of the glyoxylate cycle?
That's our version of the glyoxylate cycle. Well, we don't... It would be, I suppose, if we stored odd-chain fatty acids in order to make glucose. I mean, because the glyoxylate cycle is an intentional cycle that takes stored fat and makes it into glucose. All of them. This is kind of like an accident. I mean, it's an unintended consequence. It's one way the body can handle odd-chain fatty acids. All right. Very long-chain fatty acids greater than 22 are oxidized in peroxisome. The fatty acid CoA is directly acted upon by oxygen, makes this double-bonded and peroxide here. That hydrogen peroxide is then reduced by catalase. And since it's the direct oxidation, it means two fewer ATP per oxygen cycle produced. So this then goes through another oxidizing process, just like the beta oxidation, but it's for very long fatty acid chains. Next thing, let's see here. Boom. All right. Now, did that in one click. Next line, soluble, starvation, acetone, beta-hydroxybutyrate are the five things that are listed there. Top one is soluble. The one below that is called starvation. The three other blanks then are acetoacetate, acetone, and beta-hydroxybutyrate. You must recall that those are the three compounds designated as ketone bodies. Those are the three compounds designated as ketone bodies. And as the diagram here indicates, it's essentially the water-soluble fat. Major portion of acetyl-CoA produced by fatty acid oxidation or glycolysis enters a metabolic pathway that produces soluble forms of fat. Because fat, of course, is difficult to deal with because you're a water-based animal and the fat is not water-soluble. But they've reduced it in size to make it and added oxygens to it to make it much more water-soluble. The ketone bodies are important sort of energy equivalent of the blood for muscle. So if you're exercising regularly, you're using lots of ketone bodies from your adipose tissue through your liver. And also for the brain during starvation, exclusively during starvation. If you take an overdose of insulin that removes too much glucose from your blood, you will die. You will starve your brain to death, and that will cause death. Okay? That's because insulin can remove the glucose faster than the body can respond by providing ketone bodies for energy for the brain. The brain takes a few days, a couple days, 3 days of starvation for it to switch from glucose to fat to ketone bodies. Yes.
Is that when it
starts
to mark in the urine when you're there, you suspect like you're starving or have some sort of...
Exactly. Yep. Ketone bodies exist at high levels during starvation and other metabolic diseases as well. This is not just starvation, but other metabolic diseases. Yes. Beta-hydroxybutyrate. Do I say... Correct. It's not a ketone.
That's misleading.
It is misleading. It's not just me. Everybody who has ever called it ketone bodies has this, and they include this, and there's no ketone even close to it. Okay? Yep. So it's an old term phrase. They knew the acetoacetate when they discovered that the beta-hydroxybutyrate and these other two were intimately linked, they just lumped them all together, even though the beta-hydroxybutyrate was not truly a ketone body. All right, so need to know the structure. Pathways. So how do you end up getting acetoacetate? Well, what happens here is the primary ketone body is acetoacetate. There is another enzyme that hydrogenates it, or actually reduces it to make that that alcohol group there, makes it slightly more water soluble, and that's beta-hydroxybutyrate dehydrogenase. But the primary ketone body is that acetoacetate. Let's go on to the next one, shall we? I don't think there's much here. Yeah. Diabetes, there's one blank. Diabetes. Put in, write down the word. You see where it says diabetes? Diabetes. Yeah, put in diabetes. Production of acetoacetate. This occurs in the liver primarily. You get two acetyl-CoAs. You connect them together. You make this acetyl-CoA. You then add another two carbon units to another acetyl-CoA, HMG-CoA reductase, a synthetase, HMG-CoA synthetase, because this is called beta-hydroxy, beta-methylglutaryl CoA, HMG-CoA. Say HMG-CoA for me. HMG-CoA. Woohoo! The reason why I asked you to say it is because I want you to remember it. You guys are taking off for your systems test? Okay. Bye. Good luck. My deepest sympathies. All right. And then finally, you've got this hydroxymethylglutaryl CoA lyase, which breaks it apart into a four-carbon unit and another two-carbon unit, which is then immediately recycled. So this is the pathway that allows you to make this acetoacetate, which is the primary ketone body. The interesting thing here is this HMG-CoA, if you would put on your notes that HMG-CoA is a cholesterol precursor. HMG-CoA is a cholesterol precursor. And the enzyme HMG-CoA synthase and other enzymes immediately following the production of the HMG-CoA are targets for cholesterol metabolism-altering drugs. So this HMG-CoA synthase has been a target. Let's see here. I don't remember the exact name of it. But there's a drug on the market that is designed for cholesterol lowering. Levitra? Something like that. And it targets that enzyme right there to reduce HMG-CoA production, to reduce the amount of cholesterol being made. So once this is made, acetoacetate, what happens to it? Well, as you know, you can. There's another enzyme that can make it into beta-hydroxybutyrate. So you have this form or this form. But what comes in here is that you get this succinyl-CoA that transfers its succinyl group to it. You get this acetyl-CoA, and then you get attacked by a thiolase, which then makes two acetyl-CoAs. Where's that thiolase? Where have you seen that before? Where's that thiolase come from? What? Clays and ester cleavage. In other words, you get it from the last reaction in what pathway? There's thiolase. I've seen thiolase before. At any rate, I thought it was right here, but this is actually has a more complicated name. This is a thiolase. Thought it was at the bottom of this because it is extremely similar. Do you notice carbonyl group, carbonyl group? And you notice here how it's done right. Whoop, not there. Not there, yes. It's done right there. Doom. And so that thiolase is a relative, at least, of what happens at the base of beta oxidation. All right. And lastly, production of acetone. This occurs when acetoacetate is produced in excess, such as uncontrolled diabetes. Acetone is produced by the non-enzymatic decarboxylation of acetoacetate. Have you ever had diabetic shock? So no one's ever had to give you mouth-to-mouth or smelled your breath and it smelled like acetone, sweet. Okay. Well, good for you. That's why you're going to live a nice, long life. Acetoacetate, acetone, and single step. All right. Now then, we've got another. So what have we just accomplished, ladies and gentlemen? OK? Can someone give me a mental image of what we just accomplished so far in this chapter? We ate some fat, and what did we just get finished doing? Oxidizing it down to carbon dioxide and water. What happens with the odd chain fatty acids we just ate because we were eating vegetable oil? Succinate, which eventually could be made, which is made into pyruvate, which normally enters the citric acid cycle, but theoretically could be made into glucose. Now, this next step now deals with fatty acid biosynthesis. Oh, I didn't give myself a stop sign. Fatty acid biosynthesis. What we're now going to do is we're going to compare these two things. There's the beta oxidation, there's biosynthesis. Beta oxidation, how does the body separate these two opposing processes? One of the primary ways it separates it is physically locating the two processes in different locations in the cell. Beta oxidation occurs where? And the biosynthesis occurs where? Cytoplasm. Here you see where the carrier group is that CoA group. And FAD is the electron acceptor in the first step. You get this L-hydroxyacyl group. NAD plus is an electron acceptor. The two-unit product is acetyl-CoA. But going backwards from here, you see that the carrier group is not acyl, is not a CoA, but ACP. Acyl carrier protein is what it's called. We'll see that a little later. You take this acyl carrier protein. Malonyl is a two-carbon unit donor. So you've got this now, this unit that's two-carbon larger. NADPH is reducing. NADPH is reducing. And boom, you get your fatty acyl-CoA that's two carbons longer, still attached to acyl carrier protein. So the carrier group is ACP. The electron donor is NADPH because this is biosynthesis. Biosynthesis. Biosynthesis uses what as a reducing source? NADPH. NADH is almost exclusively, notice the little weasel word, what did I say? Almost. Exclusively used for energy. Energy transduction, energy production. And NADPH, and I need to really use a weasel word there, is almost exclusively used for biosynthesis. So, let's take a look at what that means, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Types of separation. Boom, 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 boom. Oh, too far. Back up. That's what I get for not putting stop signs here. As you can tell, this is the new section. And boom. All right. So, types of physical separation. I think I mentioned it already. Physical separation. It's different parts of the cell. The carrier molecule is different. The carrier for oxidation is CoA. For synthesis, it's ACP, acyl carrier protein. The electron carriers, the stereoform of the intermediate. What does that mean, the stereoform of the intermediate? Well, let's take a look at it. Yeah, one side is L and the other side is D. That's right. And then the products and initial reactants are unique. So, acyl-CoA produced in the mitochondria, if you're going to make fat out of it, has got to be made, if it's produced in the mitochondria because of pyruvate dehydrogenase, it's got to be carried outside the mitochondria into the cytosol because that's where biosynthesis occurs. So, that's why it says here, acetyl-CoA produced in the mitochondria is transported out of the mitochondria to participate in fatty acid biosynthesis. Acetyl-CoA transported out is in the form of citric acid or citrate. An elaborate transport system is required. Note the production of NADPH right here. So here's the mitochondria. You start out with citrate here. Down here, we'll start down here. Here's the mitochondria. You get your pyruvate coming in from glycolysis, transported in. The pyruvate carboxylates makes oxaloacetate, and acetyl-CoA attaches to it. The citrate synthate goes in, makes a citric acid. That gets carried out. So now you have high levels of citrate in the cytosol. A lyase breaks it apart into a 2-carbon unit and a 4-carbon unit. The 4-carbon unit then is recycled back down to pyruvate, which is then transported back into this mitochondria. And so you can produce NADPH here, oddly enough, which is kind of handy. You don't use NADH here, but you actually get to produce NADPH. That's kind of handy for making, if you're going to make the citric, if you're going to make fatty acids, that's handy to be able to make the NADPH there. And I think I'm done. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you guys on Monday. Now, you have the take-home quiz with you, is that right? For those of you who lose it, I'm going to post it on D2L.